I'm Julia Boorstin, and you're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Good Wednesday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Fort and Deirdre Bosa. Coming up on the show today, Coinbase's first outside investor, the CFO of Unity Software on their big cloud deal, plus earnings exclusives with the CEOs of Fubo TV and Doximity, and then a mega deal in the cybersecurity space, NortonLifeLock merging with Avast PLC. Dee?
Well, Carl, we start off our feed this morning with Coinbase, of course. Shares of the crypto exchange seeing a boost this morning as the company reports strong second quarter earnings. It's second as a public company, $1.6 billion in net profit, a nearly 4,900% boost from a year earlier. Monthly users and trading volume also seeing double-digit gains from the first 3 months of the year. But could volatility in crypto scare off future investors? That's a question here. Coinbase says it expects trading volume will be lower in the third quarter, and for good reason. Bitcoin fell more than 41% in the second quarter, and 95% of Coinbase's second quarter revenue came from transactions. Coinbase countering, quote, "We're used to the volatility. We embrace the volatility. And guys, why wouldn't they? Especially if that means more transaction, more volume." What stuck out to me here, though, was that institutional volume, greater than 50% growth. Retail volume was half of that. But on that front, guys, we've talked to some big players in the space this week, and we know that competition is increasing. FalconX yesterday, that's a platform dedicated specifically to institutional crypto investors. And then Binance, right? Remember CZ? He said that he really wanted to get regulation compliance in place, and that's likely a bid to get some of these big players as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Carl, it seems to me that this is back to that. Today's story is not tomorrow's story. We heard from Robinhood that they expect in the second half volatility is going to cool down in crypto, and that's going to hit their top line as well. And no reason why we shouldn't expect that from Coinbase. But people used to say, oh, I don't know about Bitcoin, but I believe in blockchain. And yet these valuations lately are based on all of this excitement around Bitcoin and the likes of that. So if that cools off, I wonder, is the blockchain-based technology, are the platforms that they have in place kind of ready to justify that kind of valuation that has come from all of this hype?
Yeah, a large degree of people saying maybe the overall currency platform has some escape velocity, especially as institutional demand begins to come in. Joining us to react to Coinbase's earnings and why he thinks their proof of stake service could make them the AWS of crypto, early Coinbase investor and Initialized Capital founder Gary Tan. Gary, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Carl, thanks a lot for having me back.
Some of the trading volume numbers, I just wonder if you think it does sort of ratify this belief that demand is broadening out.
Look, you know, 68 million verified users and the transacting users up 44% in a single quarter. That's a ridiculously big stat. You know, Microsoft and Apple were on-ramp to personal computers. Google was an on-ramp to the World Wide Web. And Coinbase is that on-ramp to the next revolution that's remaking society, which is crypto. 68 million users is not a small number, but we're really just scratching the surface of where this is going to go. And, you know, this company that's throwing off billions of dollars in real earnings per year in an area of extreme growth, you know, net income is up more than 100% quarter on quarter. And that's crazy. You know, we're at 1% here.
Yeah. Their guidance about Q3 volume. We've also heard sort of ancillary comments from companies like MasterCard saying that they are seeing a decline, at least a sequential decline in people using credit to buy crypto. Are we going to look back and think that at Q1 or Q2 was the peak in terms of volume?
You know, it's anyone's guess. The crypto has been always volatile. There have been something like a dozen or more 90% drawdowns in crypto. So that's what we mean. If you're, you know, an old hand, you know, you're also diamond hands because you're going to hold on to it knowing that there's going to be extreme volatility. But, you know, one thing that I think is happening is that we're realizing that this era of just speculation and buy and hold, I think it's coming to an end. You know, Coinbase has made more than $100 million in net income just from subscription rev, and that almost doubled as well. So this isn't you know, just a transaction platform. A lot of people say that, oh, it's a trading platform. It's actually platform software like Microsoft or Apple, and nobody else is even close. And a lot of this is actually driven by, you know, DeFi. You know, crypto holders are realizing they shouldn't just sit there and wait for this, you know, number to go up. They want yield. And, you know, it's not enough to hold crypto. You've got to make yield on it through staking and lending. And that's what DeFi, mostly on Ethereum, is actually providing.
Right. So, Gary, you're saying that you're already seeing signs of that diversification in terms of their revenue. Good morning, by the way. It's Deirdre. There's a lot of scrutiny and questions over the last few weeks as to what exactly backs stablecoins like USDC and Tether. Coinbase's CFO, Alesia Haas, was asked about it this morning on Squawk. We'll play a clip for you.
You can always redeem your USDC for one US dollar. And so the spirit of the disclosure was that you can always get a dollar back for the USDC that you hold.
Except, Gary, that is far from certain if there is a run on something like USDC. So I wonder, does Coinbase have a responsibility to ask for more transparency when it comes to stable coins, and especially as USDC and USDT make up a larger and larger part of the crypto ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, I do, you know, to my knowledge, USDC is the most safe, one of the safest places in terms of, you know, actually being something that will be there, even in a run.
Why is it safest?
I mean, USDC is backed by you know, American companies that are subject to U.S. regulation, and, you know, they're, you know, to my knowledge, audited. And so that's the thing about USDT. You know, I think that Tether is something that is, you know, external to the United States and run by companies that are not sort of beholden to, you know, the U.S. government regulatory authorities. And, you know, I think that looking at what happened with the infrastructure bill in the past couple weeks, you know, it's actually incredibly important that American companies do that regulation, because that's how consumers can be safe in this new economy.
So there is that distinction. However, neither of them are properly audited. They provide attestations, and USDC does have U.S. accountants, which some see to be better. But in terms of the commercial paper that they hold and some of their even short-term holdings, it's far from clear what that consists of and what happens if there is a run on this. So I just wonder, though, do you think that Coinbase, especially as it tries to be the platform most compliant, in line with regulations, has a responsibility to push them for a proper audit, not just an attestation, and tell, you know, its traders on the platform what exactly they're holding?
I guess the number one thing to me here is that, you know, if you're working with an established American financial institution that's subject to our laws, then actually they're also subject to our courtrooms. And that's actually what consumers really care about. In fact, not just American consumers care about that. Consumers around the world care about the American rule of law. And that's a good thing when it comes to crypto.
Gary, I want to go back to Coinbase itself. And there are a bunch of other public companies that are doing a lot in the crypto space. And you talk about it being the future in early days. But I think back 20 years ago, when there were a lot of companies saying the same thing about the internet, and they were right, but it was very, very early days. And you had a lot of stocks that went like this in 99, 2000, and then did like this for about a decade before coming back up. How do we know that's not going to happen with crypto specifically, and what the areas are where the meaningful innovation will happen that's not already overvalued?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one area of absolute extreme growth is decentralized finance. And, you know, you can go online and, you know, go to DeFiPulse.com. You can actually see how much DeFi has actually grown. It is by leaps and bounds, something like 10x or more, you know, something like 30 or 40x really over the course of a year. And so anything that can grow that quickly, you know, like I said earlier, it's that people, you know, should not just look at their crypto and say, I want this number to go up. They should actually be able to use it for lending, for real world services. And that's what decentralized finance is about. You shouldn't have to ask for permission to be able to transact with assets that you own. The other really bright spot, I would say, is NFTs. You know, Jay-Z minted an NFT recently. And, you know, I think that that's going, you know, quite a bit larger at this point. You know, what we're realizing is we want art, we want ability to, you know, transact in games and have those have an impact outside of those games. You know, that's just scratching the surface in terms of what these decentralized platforms can do.
Finally, Gary, on that very point, news organizations are still looking into these reports that hackers perpetrated what Bloomberg today calls is likely the biggest theft ever in the world of decentralized finance, stealing about $600 million in cryptocurrency. I mean, at what point do numbers like that act as a deterrent to use?
You know, the best thing about this is, you know, these are open distributed ledgers. And so these are transactions that you can trace. And so that's where companies like TRM Labs or Chainalysis will become increasingly important, not just for selling to the government and to law enforcement, but actually also to, you know, normal financial institutions that, you know, I think that anti-money laundering will expand, and it will expand all the way over to everything having to do with crypto transactions as well. So, you know, this is software. Software is never created perfect. And so there will be bugs and there will be hacks. But the important thing is, what, you know, what's the provenance beyond that? And I think that, you know, our engineers are going to come up with fixes for this as well. And, you know, there will be a startup and a few that already exist that solve this problem.
Yeah, let's hope so. Gary, great stuff on Coinbase and beyond. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's get some more on what Carl just mentioned. $600 million stolen in what might be one of the biggest crypto thefts ever. Eamon Javers has more. Eamon?
Yeah, John, it just might be. It's a $600 million mystery right now. Who stole all that cryptocurrency, and why have they already begun to return some of the stolen assets? Hackers exploited a vulnerability in Poly Network, which is a platform designed to connect different blockchains to enable what is known as decentralized finance, or as they call it, DeFi. Earlier today, Poly posted a message on Twitter addressed directly to the hackers. Here's what they said. The amount you hacked is the biggest one in the DeFi history. Law enforcement in any country will regard this as a major economic crime, and you will be pursued. It is very unwise for you to do any further transactions. The money you stole are from tens of thousands of crypto community members, hence the people. You should talk to us to work out a solution. Now, as of about an hour ago, it appears that some progress was being made in these negotiations between Poly and the hackers. Poly reported that the hacker has returned more than $4.7 million of those stolen assets. That's still a far cry from the total amount taken. And just within the past couple of minutes, there have been reports that even more may have been returned. Generally, crypto criminals try to use crypto mixers and servers in offshore jurisdictions that don't cooperate with U.S. law enforcement to launder the proceeds of their crimes. This group's apparent failure to do that leaves experts such as our CNBC analysts at Q6 Cyber to speculate that the crooks here could be amateurs or someone who did this simply to prove that there's a vulnerability in the system. But for now, guys, it is still an enormous mystery. Back over to you.
Yeah, I mean, and they're returning so far about 1%, maybe a little less. That's still a lot that they're potentially sitting on. Eamon, you've got some news on another hack this morning involving Accenture. They potentially have a lot of, you know, privileged information about clients. How serious is this?
Well, we're not sure right now. This is a live ball that's happening even as we speak. A hacker group known as Lockbit Ransomware says they have hacked the consulting firm Accenture, and they'll release data in several hours. They're also offering to sell insider Accenture information to interested parties. Now, the post that they put up on the dark web says, in part, these people are beyond privacy and security. I really hope that their services are better than what I saw as an insider. If you're interested in buying some databases, reach us. So that's the offer to sell the data. Now, Accenture confirms the hack to CNBC just a short time ago, but they're minimizing the scale of the damage here. They're saying in a statement, through our security controls and protocols, we identified irregular activity in one of our environments. We immediately contained the matter and isolated the affected servers. We fully restored our affected systems from backup. There was no impact on Accenture's operations or on our clients' systems. So you note there, John, that in the Accenture statement, they're silent, really, on what data was stolen or how much data was stolen. The hackers here say within the next couple of hours, they may start to release that on the dark web, and we will update you if we see that start to fly on the dark web, John.
Yeah, a lot of criminal activity out there. Eamon Javers, thank you. Now, still to come, earnings interviews with execs from Fubo TV, Doximity, and Unity Software, all three stocks sold. soaring right now. Big Hour Tech Check just underway.
A gut check on NortonLifeLock, the company buying cybersecurity firm Avast for $8.6 billion. The cash and stock deal will strengthen the cyber safety platform, they say, make it available to more than 500 million users, according to the CEO. Comes amid an increase in hacks and ransomware attacks, of course. Shares up 8%, guys. D, that's going to take you back almost about the middle of July, July 14th.
Meanwhile, Unity Software reporting another strong quarter. The company also announcing plans to acquire high-performance remote desktop and streaming tech company Parsec in a $320 million deal, leaning further into the remote work model. Joining us now to talk about the results and more, CFO Luis Visoso. Luis, thanks for being with us today. Shares are up, as we noted, but really the focus is all on that acquisition. And the team alluded to the idea that this does go beyond gaming and is the beginning of a deeper cloud push for Unity. Can you elaborate on that for our audience?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. You're absolutely right. This is a broader game, but we've been committed to win outside of gaming for a long time. That's part of our strategy, has been there for a long time. But this is an important move for us, and you're right, we're moving more and closer to the cloud, which is a key strategy for us. We're very happy with Parsec. They've been with us for a while. You know, we've been using them. They've been going viral within our company, and we just saw tremendous traction. And as we research the market, they're getting good success with other gaming companies, non-gaming companies, and we thought they would fit in very well into our portfolio.
So, Luis, how does this change or not change the strategy, and especially the way that you guys make money? Right now, it's largely an advertising model, but pushing deeper into the cloud, into remote workspaces, how does that change the direction of the company? And also, you said on the call last night that you'd be looking for more M&A, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I think maybe I'll take that last point. We'll always be looking at organic and inorganic plays. We look at these three filters, as I mentioned on the call yesterday. Do they make strategic sense? Do they strengthen our position in the market? Can we create value with them? Can we make money with it, you know, generate a return for our shareholders? And is the difficulty of the dive doable, right? Is that something we can actually execute and do a good job with that? But yeah, if I go back to your first question, fundamentally, the company doesn't change, right? The Create business is doing great. We're growing 31%. We're getting great success with game companies and non-game companies. Now, I talked about manufacturing, automotive, aerospace, defense. So we're getting success with very diverse industries, which is very exciting. And then Operate just killed it. Now, they had a 63% growth, which is a great acceleration from last quarter. And what we're seeing is that the preparation into IDFA was very successful. What we're hearing from customers is great, that really our product, which is called Pinpointer, Audience Pinpointer, is making a big difference because we're able to deliver a better return to our customers, which is really what we're here for. Mm. So the fundamental business really doesn't change.
Luis, take us a little bit deeper on the strategy here with Parsec and maybe get into the degree to which you expect the Parsec customer base is going to take you deeper beyond gaming. And I can't help but remember last year, a lot of game developers' schedules got upended by the fact that they had to be remote. There were a lot of high-stakes games that ended up being late because of that. This technology would allow them to use their powerful machines even if they're not sitting in front of them. And to what degree does that translate to other industries?
That's absolutely right. That's exactly the strategy and what we're seeing within, you know, Unity. We're seeing them traction with games. But we believe, as you said, whenever you need to access a very powerful computer, which is not with you, that's where this is a relevant technology. And they have significant customers outside of gaming, some large customers. They are still small, but we're seeing great expansion rates, as I mentioned in the call yesterday. And that's what is very exciting.
The non-gaming thing is interesting as well. You cite a couple of different examples of new customer brands, eyewear manufacturer, for example. Is that part of the business going to give the gaming part a run for its money? Do you see the size of the company's focus switching to non-gaming over time?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's switching. It has always been there for many, many years. If you know, John has said it before, I think if you look at out 5 years, if you look at 10 years, the non-gaming business would be larger than the gaming business. Now, that doesn't mean that the opportunities within games are not massive. I think that there is a massive opportunity within games. Now, John talked about our 50% market share that we have today. We think we can continue to grow. A key focus area within games is obviously winning with artists. Now, John alluded to that yesterday. But then outside of gaming, I think that the opportunity is, as I said, much larger. You know, and I believe that in a few years, that business will be larger for sure.
Yep, you're not the only one. Luis, thank you so much for being with us. Luis Visoso, Unity CFO. John?
Pleasure to be.
Now coming up, the FTC takes aim at Uber, plus FuboTV says its revenue could double this year. No slowdown there. CEO is up next. Stay with us. Welcome back to Tech Check. We are approaching the bottom of the hour. I'm John Fort with Deirdre Bosa and Carl Quintanilla. In just a minute, we're going to talk to the CEO of FuboTV. That stock is up big, more than 10% after Q2 results, levels it hasn't seen in about 6 weeks as subscribers there continue to be higher. But first, let's get a news update with Rahel Solomon. Rahel.
Hi, John. Good morning. And here's what's happening at this hour. Consumer prices rose last month at their slowest pace since February. The half percentage point increase was in line with forecasts. Used car prices edged up only slightly after posting big jumps for three consecutive months. Crude oil prices trimming morning losses that topped 2.5%. The White House calling on OPEC and other oil-producing nations to increase production to try to fight rising gas prices. The Biden administration saying that OPEC should pump more crude to make sure that the global recovery stays on track. Shares of Southwest Airlines are racing losses of more than 2.5% this morning. The stock rebounding even after Southwest lowered Q3 revenue guidance and said that the spread of the Delta variant will make it difficult for the airline to post a quarterly profit. And Wendy's stock popping more than 3%, earnings per share topping estimates, and nearly tripling year-ago profits. Same restaurant sales shot up 16% in U.S. locations and grew nearly twice as fast internationally. It's a lot of Frosties, Deirdre. I'll send it back to you.
But so good. Rahel, thank you. With the S&P hitting another record high today and the NASDAQ lagging a bit, let's take a look at which stocks and tech are showing the most strength and which have lagged. Dom Chu is at the Telus Trader with one way to measure valuations right now, Dom.
All right. So, Deirdre, we're looking at some of the momentum that has kind of taken over the technology and communication services sector. So we kind of lumped them both together. And it turns out about 19 stocks within those two sectors are trading 20% or higher above their 200-day average price. Now, that's one trend line that many traders and investors use as a gauge for the longer-term performance or price trends for a particular stock. Now, if you take a look at these sectors between technology and communication services, these two ETFs track them. And as you can see here, the comm services sector has outperformed technology. Technology has been a market performer for the most part, but each of these sectors is roughly 13% higher than their respective 200-day average prices. So again, trading with some decent relative strength. Within the technology sector, these three companies in particular have been momentum upside huge winners in this whole trade over the last year. Fortinet on the cybersecurity side on a year-to-date basis has doubled your money. Gartner on the IT research side, 84% gains, and NVIDIA about a 50% gain. What's more important, from a 200-day average price perspective, Fortinet's about 60% above that level. Gartner's about 50% above is, and NVIDIA is about 30% above its 200-day average price. So even from an average basis, really outperforming. Within communication services, two stocks fit that bill, at least 20% gains. We're talking about Google parent company Alphabet and also Interpublic Group. Both of these stocks have been huge winners year to date, and both of them are trading roughly 30% above their 200-day average price as well. And then, of course, the winners go towards the laggards sometimes. Within that communication services sector, media companies like Viacom and Discovery have both been laggards, and Take-Two Interactive as well. Take-Two, Viacom, roughly 11% below their 200-day average price, and Discovery Communications, the Class A shares, roughly 20% below there. So, Carl, if you take a look at comm services and technology, there have been a number of real outside standouts. Fortinet continues to be a huge workhorse on that momentum side of things. Back over to you.
All right, Dom. And sticking with the advertising business, Fubo TV out with earnings. The stock's popping on that news. The streaming TV company, known for its sports rights, delivered a larger loss than expected, but did see strong revenue growth and triple-digit year-on-year growth in subs. Big ad revenue gains as well, up over 280%. Remember, this is a stock that got caught up in the meme trade, spiking above 60 a while ago back in December. Joining us this morning is Fubo TV's CEO and co-founder, David Gandler. David, welcome. It's good to see you again.
Yep. Thank you, Carl. Thank you for having me.
We mentioned some of the growth metrics, but you also do increase your revenue and sub guidance for the full year. Maybe just start by explaining how sports fits in, just what a powerful driver sports is right now.
Yeah, I mean, sports is the key to our business. I mean, as you guys know, we differentiate in the virtual MVPD space. The way we like to position ourselves is come for the sports and stay for the entertainment. And sports has been a solid driver for us, typically in the third and fourth quarter with the start of the NFL season. But as you see from our Q2 earnings, we had a very solid quarter, and we continue to take market share in terms of entertainment hours viewed.
You mentioned hours per sub. Average last year in 2020, 7.2 hours a day.
That's
where we really couldn't do anything else but watch television. Far this year, the average is about 7 hours. I guess I'm wondering whether or not you're surprised there hasn't been a more dramatic drop off.
No, I'm actually not surprised at all. I think what this really highlights is the fact that the bundle is actually quite important. People enjoy having access to more content than they do less content. And you could see that, again, just through the viewership hours that we're able to, drive over this quarter and the ensuing quarters, which gives us confidence in our forecast.
David, I wonder if your strong results, especially those subscriber numbers in relation to what we saw recently from Roku and Spotify, do you worry that that will entice other bigger players moving into the sports streaming space like Amazon that are very well capitalized to push further and then raise costs for you guys?
Yeah, look, this has been an issue that people have talked about for, since the inception of Fubo, which is an only 6-year-old company. With a lot of room to grow. Amazon has been in the sports space. As you know, they've acquired the Thursday night game with respect to the NFL. The deals that are currently in place are 10 years long, the broadcast deals that I'm referring to around the NFC, CBS games, NBC, Fox. And so, we feel very good about our position, and we're creating a new category of television, one that includes video streaming, and sports betting. And, we're very excited about the prospects of creating more of an interactive experience for our users.
And tell us more about the sports betting. You're sort of starting off with these friendly wagers, it seems, and building the motion with your subscriber base, but do plan, I think, to move into real money state by state as that's possible. But when you come mm-hmm. for the sports and sort of stay for the entertainment, and I guess wagering is part of that, how big a part of the platform and the overall business picture does that become?
Yeah, so this is actually a very important step in the evolution of our business. I think, you guys have seen firsthand the evolution of Netflix and Roku and even Spotify moving from being a music company to an audio company. So we're kind of in the same phase. I think what's important is to Carl's comments is that we control over 130 hours of screen time in a household. So I think this allows us, similar to the way Amazon builds its business, allows us to create new verticals that will drive revenue for the company. So sports betting is an adjacency that, I believe works really well. As we the data we provided from our FTP, which is our free-to-play games, you can see that the engagement hours had increased by 37%, on Roku, for instance. So we're looking at betting as a potential opportunity that can drive, significant upside to the overall ARPU, which is $71 today. Long-term, we believe that, subscription revenue will be around 80%, advertising revenue is 20. So think of it as $80 and $20 of ad revenue on a monthly basis. With wagering, we think that can add another $10 to $15 of TV ARPU, if you will. That's total gaming revenue divided by the number of customers we have on the video platform. So it could be significant, and it's also got a 50% margin associated with it. So again, these are very strong economics that we think will really drive value.
Finally, you know, it's been a couple of weeks of dramatic M&A within online gaming, at least. Is sportsbook something that you see providing a path to M&A, either as a buyer or a seller?
Yeah, so we've acquired two companies. I mean, we've been public, at least listed on the NYSE, for less than a year. We've made two acquisitions. We're very happy with the acquisitions that we made. And as you could see from the results, we've been able to really build out some of the free-to-play and now getting very close to an imminent launch in the fourth quarter of our sportsbook. So, you know, right now we're being more acquisitive. You know, obviously there's a lot of M&A that we're looking at right now, but I think we're well positioned, you know, to be part of that ecosystem and, you know, to continue to take share.
David, appreciate it very much. So many fascinating crosswinds right now in advertising and media. David Gandler, Fubo TV.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Meanwhile, Cathie Wood is loading up on a SPAC that is merging with a biotech company backed by the likes of Bill Gates. That stock is Soaring Eagle. Head over to CNBC.com/pro to find out more. Tech Check is back in two.
Uber-backed EV company Joby Aviation closing its SPAC merger today. Our Phil LeBeau talked to the CEO earlier this morning here at the NYSE with a giant aircraft outside. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Carl, behind me is the Joby eVTOL. That stands for Electric Vertical Takeoff and Landing. This aircraft is the full future for Joby. They are planning on this going into service by 2024, carrying up to four passengers. It will have a pilot, at least initially, a range of 150 miles. And the CEO says, look, they're going to have skyports all over cities around the country.
We've released footage that shows just how markedly different it is in both the absolute noise and in the quality of the noise from traditional aircraft. That means we're going to be able to put skyports on the tops of buildings everywhere.
Tops of buildings, that's what they're planning on. By the way, well, when we talked with Joe Ben Bever earlier, he said they expect pilotless eVTOLs by 2030. Not sure the regulators will be on board with that, but that's his expectation at this point. And remember, Joby is the first to go public, but it's not going to be the last. There are others who are developing eVTOLs right now. Several of them are planning to eventually go public, whether through SPAC mergers or through other means. You've got Archer, Beta, Lilium, Vertical Aerospace. There are probably 12 to 15 players in this space who are developing these aircraft, and they all are targeting 2024, 2025 when they expect them to come to service. John, one last thing to keep in mind. I was at NASDAQ 11 years ago when Tesla went public. And at the time, they had some roadsters parked out front. And that was just for an electric car. And a lot of people kind of looked at it and they said, well, that's very nice. Not really sure this company will do anything. There is not that level of skepticism here with Joby. I'm not saying that Joby will be the next Tesla. What I am saying is that expectations when it comes to this type of technology certainly have changed over the last decade.
Yeah, and we'll see if they're any better at their timelines than Elon Musk. But you can be successful, good timeline or not. Phil LeBeau, thank you. Also, just to note, I'm going to be speaking with Joby investor and LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman today at 1 p.m. Eastern, part of an event for the Economic Club of Chicago. We'll have more from that conversation here on Tech Check tomorrow and a lot more Tech Check today. Straight ahead.
Check out shares of Uber. They are down nearly 3.5% this morning, and they're still languishing below its IPO price back from 2019. That was $45 at the time. Now its growth strategy may be the focus of antitrust regulators. The Federal Trade Commission, FTC, is said to be scrutinizing its partnership with convenience startup GoPuff, as well as its acquisition of an alcohol delivery startup, Drizly. That's according to The Information. CEO Darwar Khosrowshahi's strategy to gain market share and eventually reach profitability has centered around this deal-making, and now that strategy could be in the crosshairs of Lina Khan's FTC. Uber shares there down 16% year-to-date, and last week its quarterly results showed that it continues to lose money on its core business. And John, we do get DoorDash earnings after the bell tomorrow, and it's kind of remarkable. I know we've noted this before, how differently investors value these two companies. DoorDash shares are up about 30% year to date. And even if you look at something like its price to sales ratio, nearly double that of Uber. And we know that Tony Hsu has grown his company in terms of food delivery and convenience delivery more organically.
Yeah, DoorDash might be Uber's best argument here, saying, hey, look, we're not clearly that big in delivery. Look over at DoorDash. And by the way, our ride hailing business has not helped us to push into that area. We'll see how they make this argument, Carl, but definitely not the landscape that we saw a few years ago. Not sure this kind of an acquisition would have gotten or this kind of partnership would have gotten this kind of scrutiny.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of pressure from regulators on social media and e-commerce, but delivery would be a new chapter if, in fact, Lina Khan wants to take the commission that way. We'll find out. When we come back, Doximity reporting earnings for the first time as a public company. CEO is going to join us on the other side of this quick break.
Doximity shares surging today. You can see them there up about 19%, taking it to levels of about 2 weeks ago. The company releasing its first earnings report since going public in late June, with revenue doubling year over year to $72.7 million. It's a social platform for medical professionals and a technology platform for delivering care. And CNBC recently wrote a big piece on the difficulties it has faced combating misinformation on its platform, much as Facebook and YouTube have. Joining us now, Doximity co-founder and CEO Jeff Tangney. Jeff, good morning. First on these results, talk to us about what's driving this. There are different components to this platform, both networking within the medical community and then being able to securely connect doctors to patients without giving up their phone numbers, which I guess is so important for all the communication that has to happen out of the office these days.
Hi, yeah, and thanks for having us, John. Obviously an exciting day here as we report our first earnings. So yes, here at Doximity, we build software to help doctors be more productive, to help them provide the best care for their patients. So we have over 80% of all U.S. physicians as active members on our platform. And as you were just mentioning, we help them do millions of things a day, like collaborating with colleagues or telehealth calls with patients, e-signatures and workflows. So this past quarter was a great quarter for us, 100% revenue growth, as you said, led by our existing clients. So we had 167% net revenue retention rate. So same store sales or existing clients really grew a lot for us. And really what we've seen is as frontline physicians are grappling with these really high caseloads with Delta and outbreaks, we're really proud that our productivity tools have really been there to help. So our e-signature, the ability for doctors to sign off on paperwork on their phones, saw record use this past quarter. And our enterprise telehealth platform also grew to unprecedented levels. We had 24,000 physicians. We now serve over 30% of all U.S. physicians
right
with our paid telehealth platform.
Now, I'm curious about the strategic possibilities here, because this area of medical communication and technology is interesting, clearly, to the very largest technology companies. Apple and Amazon are leaning into it with wearables and want to be able to connect medical professionals to that data and those platforms. Microsoft, of course, buying Nuance, leaning into AI and data there. You have the audience that they want to reach. How are you going to play in that ecosystem?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say the easiest way to describe this is that, you know, there's a lot of folks standing up telehealth services, wanting to be the Amazon of telehealth, including Amazon itself. I'd say our approach is more like the Shopify. We're helping digitize all those existing Main Street practices that are out there, helping doctors take the practice and the patients that they already serve and see them virtually more easily. So our approach has really been more driven through working with doctors than trying to get patients. And I think that's unique in the space. And candidly, it's a little different than what I think a lot of the larger tech companies are going after these days.
Jeff, good morning. It's good to see you. It's Deirdre. I want to talk to you a little bit about the misinformation and disinformation that we have seen in comments on the site that my colleague Ari Levy wrote so well about recently. Were you prepared for this level of misinformation? And How are you addressing it? Are you increasing content moderation?
Well, thank you, Deirdre. This is honestly a bit of a hot button topic for me. I'll just start by clarifying that we're really like a Bloomberg or an Apple News, and that we provide a personalized news feed for each of our doctors. But we're really not a social media site, and that we don't let doctors create their own news posts that can then get shared and sort of go viral on others' feeds. So it's just the comments on the articles. And that all said, we have seen a tiny percent. It's like a tenth of a percent of all posts and users that have had some inaccuracies. And, you know, we own that. We're working on that. Our physician fact checkers have been working overtime. There's a lot of new emerging science out there with the Delta variants, and it's been a real growth in the amount of discourse on this topic. But I do want to be clear, really in defense of U.S. physicians, that I do think some of the headlines, not CNBC's, but others, have been overblown in saying that, you know, doctors are anti-vax. That is just not true. 96% of U.S. physicians were fully vaccinated as of a few months ago, more are today. They are staunchly pro-vaccine. It's just that there are some debates now about what herd immunity really looks like with Delta. Do we need to start testing all of our nurses in the immunocompromised patient wards, even if they have been vaccinated? So there are some nuanced discussions there, and we are policing it. We are fact-checking it all. But I do want to be clear, physicians want you to get vaccinated in this country because they don't want to have to intubate you this fall.
Yeah, it does sort of all point back to what some argue, though, has been cloudy communication from the agencies like the FDA and the CDC. And I do wonder whether or not you think that some of that communication, whether it's been muddled or not, is a driver of traffic or attention to the company.
I mean, there's no doubt we've seen an uptick in traffic and telehealth calls since July 4th. And that I think, corresponds with the COVID Delta surge that we've seen. So, yeah, as physicians can't talk to each other in hallways because they're under six layers of PPE and whatever else, you know, we become that platform for them to communicate.
All right. Certainly an important thing for our medical professionals to be able to communicate with each other. Jeff Tangney, the CEO of Doximity, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, John.
And if you missed part of the show, don't forget to follow and subscribe to our podcast. Listen anytime, anywhere, wherever you download podcasts. Tech Check is back in just a moment.
Welcome back. We were just talking pandemic and Delta variant. Events, online ticketing company Eventbrite was one of the hardest hit during the pandemic. Q2 earnings showed some recovery, though. And in a Fort Knox one-on-one yesterday, co-founder and CEO Julia Hartz told me Eventbrite sees a hybrid future where hosts put on two different types of events, one physical for a local audience and another digital for a global audience, and both can be ticketed.
It's not like they're trying to stream the same event or do it synchronously. I'm seeing an asynchronous hybrid model emerge that allows Eventbrite to know, okay, these are places that we can help them succeed. We can help creators price their tickets appropriately. We can help creators expand their audience, which is what we've done through COVID. And we just brought to market a new product that helps them market their event more successfully.
Data and digital workflows more and more important for small businesses across all kinds of things. And as always, that full conversation is online on TechCheck's LinkedIn page, streamed on Twitter at CNBC Tech Check. Carl, we're all hoping to get back to in-person stuff, but who knows when we'll be able to do it comfortably.
Yeah, it's a difficult call. I noticed, you know, of course, we've been talking about the auto show here in New York D, canceled, obviously. Stevie Nicks today had, I think, 5 dates at music festivals around the country, but she had to cancel them all because she just wanted to be cautious.
Mm-hmm. And she cited her age, right? She's over 70, double vax,
yeah.
But I'm sure a disappointment to many, but safety, right? And you're probably going to see more of this.
Indeed. It will be a topic, obviously, for some of the earnings we're going to get tonight. eBay, Sonos, and Bumble. We'll keep an eye on that. And then tomorrow, some of the real fun begins with Baidu, Airbnb, Dash, Disney, and SoFi. Also, watch Moderna here, down about 15%. Let's get to the half.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.